Hey, we're excited again to have Lonnie Dupree joining us. And Lonnie, of course, internationally known Arctic explorer, who is now the last couple of years has taken up a new adventure, a new pastime, and that's climbing very, very cold, high mountains. Lonnie, welcome back to the Roadhouse.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Buck. Thanks, Bob, for having me here again.
Were you at Eagle Mountain?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, if you were up at Eagle Mountain today, it would have probably been similar circumstances. It was windy last night.
Just a cold day today, yeah.
Yeah, I went for a short bike ride just before the show, and I had all I could do to get my cold, frozen feet out of my boots when I got back.
Yeah, I will believe that. You know, it was cold. You went up again. Now, last year, you made an attempt on Denali in January. Yeah. Nobody else has done that. This year, and you got stuck at 17,000 at the last camp by bad weather for about 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
You got stuck by bad weather again this year.
Yeah, that seems to be Denali's MO.
Yeah.
Is just bad weather in January. It's probably why it hasn't been done.
Mm-hmm.
But this year I decided to take a different approach to it. I would climb up to 14 if I was lucky enough, 14,000 feet. I'd try to put a depot win up about 15,000 feet, which I was able to do, and then go back down to 14 and wait for a weather window of about 3 days that I would need to get to the summit from there, as opposed to going all the way up to 17, which I could have, but then being stuck at 17 like last year is really debilitating with the lack of being able to absorb oxygen and exercise before you actually go on the summit. So I decided to stay at 14 and ended up getting stuck down there for seven some odd days, and then we had a long-term weather forecast that just looked like something awful coming. High winds and extreme cold, so I had all I could do to get down from there.
I don't think any of our listeners can imagine what that's like. Of course, there's no trees. It's all snow and ice. It's steep. It's really cold. And something happened early on in this climb that I wasn't aware of, because you were at a spot where you normally aren't putting it on your website, and that's right away after, I think, the first jump out of base camp getting up to 78.
Yeah, well, a couple of different things had happened to me. On the way up, above 11,200 feet, it's so windy up above 11,000 feet that it pulverizes or it pounds the snow into ice. So everything is ice. Unlike when we went up there, Buck, in 2009, I believe it was. 2010, where we had lots of snow. That's all ice in the wintertime. So it's very, very slippery. So if you fall, you start sliding very quickly. Very quickly. And so you got to get your ice axe in and self-arrest within a first couple of seconds. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to, that axe isn't going to hold you. Going up, not too much trouble, but coming down, I slipped on a place called Squirrel Hill. And it's actually not all that steep. You can down climb it going face first, but the situation was where I had very heavy winds hit me in the back, and I got pushed off my feet and began to slide. And luckily, I got my ice axe in right away. And from that point on, I couldn't stand up because the wind was so bad. So I had to basically down climb, double ice axing, using my crampon points to basically laying almost flat with a backpack on and going down. And what would normally take me 20 minutes to walk down took me 2.5 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. I was beat. I got to my snow cave at 11,000.
And then you got caught by a blizzard early on your hike up at 78, which made it really tough to even find a place to get in and protect yourself.
Yeah, actually, that was at 78 on my way out.
I could
actually see base camp on my way. I couldn't see it. I knew it was right there because it was dark at the time when I was traveling. The snow was blowing. A really super strong wind came out of the out of the east, and I thought, well, no big deal, I'll just dig down, you know, like normally. So I started digging down, and just a short 3 feet later, I hit the glacier. There was very little snow on the glacier, so I went another, I just kind of, you can't see at this point, it's snow is so, so much snow in your face. So I just went another maybe 100 yards at the max, still same way. So all I could do is dig a shallow trench out of there. I started digging at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and by 5:30, I had a spot big enough for a sleeping bag, ground pad. And I was laying in there, and I used my backpack to cover the hole. And I was laying there, and the ceiling's 5 inches from my face. I had to sleep in the kind of the fetal position, and I couldn't even get a drink out of my thermos bottle because I couldn't lift it to take a drink. So I had to kind of, you know, slurp it out of the side. And that was the one time on my trip, aside from slipping on Squirrel Hill, that I wasn't quite sure if I was going to make it, because I was worried about the wind eroding away the snow, leaving me completely exposed, because I only had 3 feet and not that great of snow either. And so I laid in there from basically 5:30 on to about 1:30, and then I could hear that the wind had died down completely, and the moonlight, it was full moon night, and moonlight was shining through the thin layer of the roof of the cave. So I decided I'm out of here. I mean, I don't get claustrophobic very easy, but when you're in a fetal position with the, you know, the roof above 5 inches from your face, it was starting to get to me. So I punched out of there, and it was the most beautiful sight I ever seen. All the mountains were highlighted. It was a full moon. I could see where I needed to go. I didn't need a headlamp either to spot crevices along the way. It was that bright. And by 4:30, I made it into base camp.
And yeah, it's just incredible.
Yeah, the snow was blowing so hard when I was trying to dig that cave. You know, I dug a shovel out, and about 3/4 of a shovel went back in. That's why it took me so long. And then my beard got so covered with ice that I was getting suffocated. And there was only a certain way you could face away from the snow to keep from suffocating. And which also made it hard to dig. So that's why it took so long. And then I finally got in the cave, and I pulled off this big sheet of ice off my face, and I looked on the inside of it, and I had all my whiskers were on the inside of that ice.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like, this isn't fun. That wasn't fun at all.
You know, I don't know if you're ready for this question, but I know it's in everybody's mind. Next year again?
I don't think so, Buck.
No.
I mean, it's expensive, and a couple years in a row, I had some help this year, but still, quite a bit came out of pocket, and so, and the weather is so fickle lately, it's really hard to get a three-day window at that time of year to get to the summit, so right now, I'm just not thinking about it, and I haven't forgot the hardships. This year it really kicked my butt this year, so I'm gonna let it slide.
Which was harder, trying to climb Denali this last January or writing this book, Life on Ice?
That's a really good question. Well, writing this book, there is a lot of time, nine and a half years, almost 10 years going into writing this book. A lot of writers, editors had helped me. A lot of folks in the community has looked over the manuscript over the years, including yourself, Buck, and Kelly Dupree, Judy Johnson, Annie Princeton in the early days, and then Jim Boyd here in town worked on it for almost a year, trying to get my 500-page scribble into some sort of manuscript to hand off to Ann Ryan, who's my publisher editor today.
But it's a huge success. I mean, the story, I just finished the book. You haven't had it that long, but it was a great read. It was hard to put down, and it kind of covers right from, you know, that first semi-polar experience you had with your dad, you know, trying to get out of a frozen swamp in the wintertime with the snow machine.
Yeah, yeah.
When you were a little guy.
Yeah, I remember it like it happened the other day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were out. We got permission from the DNR. I need to put that in there, by the way.
Oh yeah,
that we could spear northerns out of this spring hole because the lake was freezing out and choking off oxygen. Fish were going to the spring, and so we were just spearing them and throwing them up on the ice. We had about 100 northerns and on the ice. So we put them like frozen cordwood in a gunny sack, threw them on a sled, and hooked them up to this old skidoo Elan, and away across the swamp we went, and then ended up in a crossing an area thin ice and fell in. And
how old were you then, Lonnie?
You know, I try to think back, and I was like six, maybe seven, maybe five. I don't know, but I could remember it very clearly. And I just remember how cold it was because it was about 30 below zero, and we are several miles from the house. And I remember my dad trying to keep that snow machine from sinking completely down. He was just in deep enough water where he could stand to the side of it and goose it to keep the machine up on the ice as it was breaking, and at the same time trying to push me out of the water onto the ice with his other hand. And he knew... he knew what would happen if that machine sank, because I don't think we could have made it home. Mm-hmm. We were too far away. And but he got it out, and we got home.
He got you home.
We was frozen.
Yeah, I believe that. Wow. You know, anybody out there who thinks they lead an active adventurous life shouldn't read this book, because you'll feel like, man, what have I been doing? You have covered so much ground in your life in the Arctic and elsewhere. You cover everything from your trip through the Northwest Passage to the Olympics when they were in Oslo to Banks Island with your wife Kelly at the time, and your huge trip around Greenland, which is that's almost a lifetime in itself, and also. Your summer pole trips, North Pole trips in the summer and winter, summer being something that's never been done until you and Eric accomplished it. There's amazing stories in that book.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I think back, you know, I think back about the time when John and I went circumnavigated Greenland. And at the time we finished that expedition, I think I was 38 years old, and I thought I was pretty much done with doing expeditions when we rounded that thing, because that was 5.5 years, 6,000 miles of all non-motorized travel around that thing. And by the time John and I got done with that trip, our rotator cuffs hurt, our backs hurt, our knees hurt. You know, being in kayaks for, you know, 10, 12 hours a day, and then running dogs in the winter. It was a hard trip on us, financially, physically. But it was rewarding. I mean, I think that of all the trips that we've done, I think Greenland's the most rewarding, because we visited areas that, some people have never set foot in, some of them very remote areas of Northwest Greenland and Northeast Greenland, but, just the meeting the polar Inuit people and kayaking next to narwhals and things like that, and running into polar bears and having polar wolves try to attack our dogs. I mean, there's just a litany of interesting things that went on there.
You know, one of my favorite things that you've told me about, and I don't recall if it's in the book or not, but that had to be with... you're sitting in a living room with an older Inuit gentleman who's making string figures, and that week they're expecting to get connected to satellite TV.
Wow.
You know, how can you go from this for entertainment to that in one lifetime?
I remember that. I mean, John and I went, it was a little village, there was a little village of Kakadet, and you have guys sitting around the dinner table. They got anoraks on that are full of blood because they just pulled a 2,000-pound bull walrus out of the flow edge, you know, and drug it up to the house. And you got one guy doing string figures they call Aryut string games, and
that's with his hands.
That's with his hand. He can do 85 different string figures. You know, very much similar to the cat's cradle and stuff we learned in school. Only they could do figures. He could do 85. And we got that on video. But anyways, we were. That's the same day they got satellite to hook up to the satellite for television for that they could get out of Denmark. And of course, anywhere on the planet, you can have television if you got a satellite dish, right? And a little juice to go with it. And there, it was just like, wow, this is the end of a dying, you know, it's kind of the end of an era there. And
it's going to change our culture forever.
Yeah, totally. And so we, John and I felt fortunate we were able to be there at a time where that hadn't affected it yet. Mm-hmm. And I can honestly say, though, that that part of northern Greenland, northwest Greenland, and the polar Eskimos that live up there are still live very traditional life with still hunting narwhals and still collecting bird eggs and still wearing fur clothing and still traveling by dog ting is still happening today because they had very strict rules in their communities about using motorized vehicles to hunt from or travel from. They wanted to promote dog sledding, keep dog sledding a thing of the future, and travel a lot by kayak as well.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Lonnie Dupree. Lonnie has a brand new book out. It's called Life on Ice, 25 Years of Exploration. There's another story that came out of that part of your book, and you briefly mentioned it, and that was waking up with the sight of Arctic wolves outside. And maybe you can tell folks a little bit about that.
Yeah, John Holger and I have been on the trail for about a month and a half, and we're in the very northern reaches of Greenland, actually the northernmost point of Greenland, and by Cape Clarence Wyckoff, and we're camped there at night, and in the morning I could hear the dogs whining. I thought, oh, bears in camp, because we're camped right on the edge of the Arctic Ocean. And I poked my head out of the door, and lo and behold, there's four polar wolves, great big white polar wolves, sneaking up on the dogs. And I knew very well they were going to try to get have some of the dogs for lunch. And managed to take some photos of them, and then I got out of the tent. And they were in no big hurry to run off either. They stuck around for quite a while, and I got a few photographs of them, and then they took off. But these are wolves that are probably several hundred miles further north than the northern polar wolves that Dave Meach and Jim Brandenburg photographed in Ellesmere Island. So these are really the northernmost wolves. And these wolves, I figured, lived on lemmings and muskox, and also seal pups, or seals that that sun themselves on the ice. That was their mainstay.
What a sight to see, though, and that's a sight that not many people in the world see.
Well, no, and they were so mystical looking. They had just dark black noses with black you could see the black pigment in their mouth around their lips and stuff, and then they had really dark eyes, and they were really super lanky with big paws for staying up on the snow, and pretty scrawny, but you know, you could tell they could hold their own. I know they would made short work out of my lead dog. very short work.
Yeah.
And wouldn't be no small feat, because my lead dog Knut at the time was running the roost of 14 pretty burly Eskimo dogs. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something about wild animals that the rules are different.
Yeah.
Our dogs know they're
getting a meal at the end of the day. The wolves, they got to work for theirs. So.
Absolutely, they do have to.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many stories in your book, Lonnie. Maybe you would touch on one more, and that people may not have any idea about. But you actually got to, when the Olympics were in Oslo area,
yeah.
You got to lead a dog team to start off the Olympics. It's a pretty amazing story.
Yeah, of all the expeditions I've done, that was the most scary. Running a dog team that you have completely no control out of through a stadium where 50 million people are watching on television. This is like, so I got these dogs, you know, and my job was to run the dogs from one end of the stadium through the center of it, where the King of Denmark is standing on a podium in the center of the stadium, and then through the stadium out the exit. But I had to stop halfway in between to drop off one of the team members to give the King of Denmark a message. from the expedition.
Okay.
So during training, I had a film guy in my sled, and I was we were going through the stadium, and the sled clipped the podium on the end and threw the cameraman about 50 feet in the other direction and broke his camera.
Oh, man.
And the next time we went through, this is training number two, the dogs ran straight past the stadium or post, couldn't stop. I couldn't get them to stop, and they ran up three sets of bleachers to get at a guy's hot dog. So that was my two training days. And then the third time it went flawless, except for right before we were going to leave. Kelly was there at the time, actually, and she was holding the dogs, and we're getting ready to leave through the stadium, and they're going 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go, you know. And right before they said go, the guy said, "Now don't use your brake. There's trolls underneath the snow." What? What? As I said, my dogs had taken off. I'm using the brakes, yeah. Right? Well, the dogs went across flawless, and I used my brakes all the way, but they did indeed have people underneath the snow of the stadium. Oh, I don't know if you've seen the closing ceremonies, but at the end of the ceremonies, all these people popped out of the snow of the thing, and these were all trolls in little caves underneath.
Maybe there was a few that never made it.
If they would have known my cave capabilities, maybe they would have hired me for that job. But
yeah,
anyways, wow. That was pretty frightening. But anyways, from there, we traveled about 1,000 miles up through Norway, Sweden, and through Finland, and ended up in Murmansk, Russia, where I then handed the keys over to the rest of the team, and I came back to Minnesota.
Wow. Once again, Lonnie Dupree's new book is Life on Ice. It's 25 years of exploration. Where can folks find your new book, Len?
Well, they can order it on Amazon, but within the county, I'm doing a book signing at Stone Harbor tomorrow between 1 and 3. And so people can pick them up there. I'll have books at the Trading Post and Drury Lane, Ben Franklin, Cascade Lodge, Water's Edge, and Tofty. And so folks can get them there and or through the website.
Great. Yeah. Or if they spot you somewhere and say, "Hey, Lonnie, I need one of your books."
And I just so happen to have a case in my car.
Yeah, there you go.
Or three.
Yeah. We've been speaking with Lonnie.
Correct change.
Yeah, definitely bring the correct change.
Or don't.
Yeah.
We've been speaking with Lonnie Dupree. And Lonnie, of course, so well known throughout this area. But if you haven't heard of him, you better grab a book and learn about the first 25 years of his explorations. He has not written the book yet about his mountain adventures. That may be coming in the future.
Yeah, I gotta come up with a good ending.
Well, yeah. Oh, I'm sure that may well happen.
Yeah.
Lonnie, thanks for coming on the Roadhouse and sharing this with us, and good luck with the book. I don't think you're going to need much luck.
Thanks very much, Buck, and thanks, Bob, for having me again here.
Thanks, Lonnie.